the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., sits down with VOA.
This ends tomorrow if Russia pulls its troops out of Ukraine.
Plus, Vladimir Putin will not be attending the G20 summit, this amid a Russian withdrawal from Kherson.
The summit would have been the first time President Joe Biden and President Putin were together at a gathering since the start of the Russian war in Ukraine.
And later in the program, we'll find out what a power bank on wheels is and how it's being used. Today is November 10th, 2022. From the Voice of America in Washington, this is Flashpoint Ukraine. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish. We're looking at the major developments in Ukraine today. And topping the list is the Russian withdrawal from Kherson. Anna Chernikova reports for VOA. She's in Ukraine's capital city, Kyiv.
So, as we heard yesterday, Russian Federation announced that they are withdrawing from the Kherson region, which is on the right bank of the Dnipro River, and this includes the city of Kherson itself. Of course, it was a very important announcement taken into consideration that the city of Kherson was the only city, the administrative center that Russian Federation captured since February 24th, since the beginning of this full-scale invasion. However, what we have as an update for today, Ukrainian officials confirmed that Ukrainian forces actually advance in the Kherson region. They have already liberated additional 12 settlements since yesterday. And as the general staff announced, since October 1st, Ukrainian forces have already liberated over 40 settlements in that area. For the moment, we don't have confirmation that Russian forces have withdrawn all their forces from the region. Even more, Ukrainian officials say that everyone should be very careful with this kind of announcements, because it is definitely that Russian forces would not just leave, they would fight back while leaving in order to have more time and to make sure that they have take as much equipment and as much manpower that they can from that area. What we hear from the international representatives, for instance, U.S. Officials say that they already see the movement of the Russian forces from the region. In particularly, we can say that there are actions happening, but we don't, of course, know when exactly they will leave completely. And similarly, similar information we get from the British intelligence, they also predict that it will take a couple of days for Russian forces to actually completely leave the area. What is important to emphasize here, and this is also said by was said by President Zelensky and by General Staff of Ukraine, but in addition by Mr. Stoltenberg also, it's important to understand that this withdrawal is not just because Russian forces wanted to leave this area. It's because actually, Ukrainian forces managed to take control over all the supply chains that Russian Federation had in that area, and also certain tactical actions that Ukrainian forces made in order to get to that point.
Some of the news stories we're seeing here in the United States are saying that some in Ukraine are skeptical of the Russian withdrawal, saying it's a trap. Is that anything you're hearing?
There were this kind of, of talks, especially yesterday, right after the announcement. However, today, actually, it was already confirmation of certain movements, and both Ukrainian and international intelligences confirmed that. And Ukrainians continue to be very careful, and this is exactly what President Zelensky emphasized and what General Staff of Ukraine is saying, that Ukrainian forces continue their counteroffensive operation. It's nothing else than counteroffensive operation. It's not just a withdrawal. Withdrawal is a result of this counteroffensive. So nothing is taken for granted, definitely. And Ukrainian forces are getting ready for heavy battles. Ukrainian officials do not expect this to be an easy a trip to Kherson. So yes, definitely this kind of talks are in the air, and definitely Ukrainians also concerned that Russian forces could implement certain provocation, for example, with Kakhovska Dam or something like that. Ukrainian society, I should say, also getting ready for possible intensifying of shelling, because normally when Ukrainian forces have success at the battlefield, there are intensifying shelling of the Ukrainian cities.
Anna Chernikova reporting from Kyiv. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you, Steve.
Mykola Scher is a choreographer in Kyiv and skeptical of the Russian announcement and their motives.
I listened to Ukrainian presidential adviser Mykhailo Podlyak. They understand that they are ready for a trap. Our leaders have developed special plans and closely monitor the situation. It's possible that the Russians want to lure us into something. But I am certain that there are so many Ukrainian troops that the Russians probably have understood that they won't be able to hold Kherson and that they need to pull out in order to save their lives. Because if they stay, we will kill them all.
Some public reaction on the streets of Kyiv. U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. Linda Thomas-Greenfield met with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky in Kyiv this week. Later in her travels, she also spoke with VOA's Eastern Europe Bureau Chief Miroslava Gongadze in Warsaw on Wednesday.
You met President Zelensky. Mr. Salvin met President Zelensky just a few days before you. There are a lot of discussions about possible peace plan, and President Zelensky lay out his conditions for the peace plan. How do you see this possible peace plan going forward?
Well, certainly I see Ukraine in the driver's seat. And having President Zelensky lay out his conditions, I think, sets a very strong platform for any discussions that might go forward on peace. But truthfully, this ends tomorrow if Russia pulls its troops out of Ukraine. And there won't be any need for talks. Kids can go back to school. Ukrainians can start to rebuild their lives. They can start to return home. This is in Putin's hands, and we need to keep the pressure on President Putin.
United States show leadership in coordinating and organizing international community in support of Ukraine. However, some countries are not on board in supporting Ukraine. And what kind of challenges do you see in this regard, specifically before the G20 summit that is coming up?
I think the biggest challenge is to really communicate that this is not a war between Russia and the United States. It's not between East and West. This is an attack on the UN Charter. It is an attack on the sovereignty of Ukraine, an independent country, on the integrity of their borders. And that is the message that we want to get across as we go into the G20. It is a message that we work every day to get across at the United Nations. And I think we have had great success. I mean, getting 143 countries to condemn Russia's attempted annexation of Ukrainian territory, I think was a major achievement. And we will keep working to build this coalition of countries that who are prepared to very publicly condemn Russia's actions.
Next week's G20 summit in Bali, Indonesia, might be less tumultuous than previously thought. One of the big headliners has decided to skip it. The AP's Karen Chamas has the details.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin will not attend the Group of 20 summit in Indonesia. The news that Putin would not attend the G20 meeting was announced by an Indonesian government official. The move would enable the Russian leader to avoid a possible clash with the United States and its allies over the war in Ukraine. The summit would have been the first time President Joe Biden and President Putin were together at a gathering since the start of the Russian war in Ukraine. The event will take place on the Indonesian island of Bali and will start on November the 15th. I'm Karen Chamas.
You're listening to VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine. I'm Steve Karish. This week, VOA's Steve Miller spoke with Matteo Ilardo, Europe analyst with RAIN, a risk intelligence company. They discussed the challenges currently facing Europe as Russian gas flows have been restricted and what impact that will have on transitioning to greener energy. Today, they wrap up their conversation.
So speaking of long term, I mean, we're talking about a lot about the energy specifics and they're intertwined and intermingling between so many economic and industrial systems within Europe. But I wonder if you could focus a little bit more on what you perhaps see as the longer term implications for the economy, for the industrial complexes in Europe as they deal with the challenges of obtaining sufficient energy, not only for businesses, but for the constituents in the years to come longer down the road?
Yeah, that, I think that's a key question here. And I think Europe will continue to struggle in 2023 and probably until 2024, when we'll have more supply of LNG coming online in the world. Until then, as said, demand reduction will remain the key priority to reduce risks of gas rationing. So everyone will have to play its part, from governments and public buildings, private buildings, trying to reduce consumption through energy efficiency measures. But then we'll have, of course, the industrial players having to play most of the part. They'll have to reduce consumption the most and will be incentivized to do so by the fact that prices are set to remain higher for these couple of years. But then after 2024, when Europe, thanks to new supply deals signed, thanks to new infrastructure built to increase higher imports of LNG, will bring adequate supply to Europe, prices will still remain higher than they have been for the past decade, when basically European industrial base, the model, the economic model behind European industrial base was very much reliant on cheap, reliable, and continuous supply of gas from Russia.
So, Matteo, what kind of impact do you think that will have?
So we'll have several sectors having to either curtail operations and accelerate energy transition plans, having to shut altogether. Some will have to relocate abroad where energy is cheaper. And at the same time, to look at constituents, they will be definitely given priority when it comes to energy redistribution. So we'll have private households and critical infrastructure will always be given a priority over business, over industries for the allocation of gas and energy, which means that demand reduction, again, will hurt more industrial producers rather than small businesses, rather than households. And prices will also hurt European industry more.
Okay. And as we continue to look toward the future, you know, what do you kind of see over the next few years?
So I would say over the next couple of years, the situation will very much remain an emergency one, where energy reduction measures are recommended, sometimes regulated by governments, because the supply-demand balance will remain a very delicate one. And then moving on beyond 2024, prices will basically shape how gas is consumed in Europe. We'll probably see certain industries suffering from high prices and will have decreased in production, probably will have some job losses, will have these sectors, lower production, hurting economic growth across the continent. But and nothing massive in a sense that energy-intensive industries altogether only represent a relatively modest share of added value of economic output in Europe. We're talking about 5% and only a small share of employment in Europe. Again, 2%. So the impact won't be massive. It won't lead necessarily to massive political or social change, but definitely it will be relevant and prices will continue to remain high and therefore to determine what the industrial sector will look like in Europe and how it will place itself competitively in the global picture.
Matteo Ilardo is a Europe analyst with RAIN, the risk intelligence company. Matteo, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
A group of American orthopedists and technicians is in Ukraine helping people who've been waiting, sometimes for months, to get their prosthesis. Sometimes they manage to get war veterans back on their feet. Literally, in one day. For VOA, Omelan Ashuldiak has this report.
In this kitchen in Lviv, Ukraine, the cooks are working with plaster of Paris instead of dough.
Pancakes.
Got it. Prosthetics is Todd Stone's and Rob Garvin's domain.
It's something I personally find rewarding. Some people like to buy fast cars. I like to help people.
Thank you.
On the second day of the war in Ukraine, an explosion shook Kherson near the Antonovsky Bridge. Oleg Hordilay, a father of two and the manager of recycling warehouses in Kherson, was in the middle of this blast.
The bomb injured my legs. After the second, I was covered with earth. I didn't faint. I crawled into the road. A car was passing by and picked me up.
Hordilay was treated at home in Russian-occupied Kherson until July. Then volunteers helped him and his family leave. He couldn't walk for 7 months. Todd Stone and his colleagues helped him get back on his feet in a day, thanks to a new prosthesis.
Normally, prosthetic limbs will take anywhere from 1 to 4 weeks to build, depending on how complicated they are. Our first goal is we tried to bring in some technology that we've been using that will cut that down to about a day.
It is a complicated process, but one that Stone and Garvin have down to a science.
One we brought is called extremity socket. This is one that we can treat people below the knee very quickly, and it's a very neat product. It's adjustable after it's made.
Ready. This is a combination of like different types of plastics.
As Hordilay tries on his new prosthesis, everyone is nervous.
See if it fits or not. Your legs still moving?
No walk. Nope. Careful.
Then he needs to take it off and rest for a little bit, but he needs to get used to having it on.
Of course it's hard. I'm standing on my feet for the first time in the last 6 months.
A seasoned prosthetist, Stone is not holding back tears.
Make some magic happen. And when you see him cry and me cry, that's the magic happen.
Stone and Garvin work for Hunger Clinic in the US. They come to Ukraine to work for a few weeks at random clinics. They are members of a team of American specialists that includes prosthetists, orthopedists, and technicians. They help as many people as they can and pass along with their knowledge to their Ukrainian colleagues. Omelyan Ashuldiak for VOA News, Lviv, Ukraine.
President Joe Biden commented today on Brittany Griner. The basketball star has been imprisoned in Russia since shortly after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Reuters' Ryan Chang has the details.
U.S. President Joe Biden said Wednesday he expects Russian leader Vladimir Putin to get more serious about discussing the release of U.S. basketball star Brittany Griner and a potential prisoner swap.
My hope is that now that the election is over, that Mr. Putin will be able to discuss with us and be willing to talk more seriously about prisoner exchange. That is my intention. My intention is to get her home. And we've had a number of discussions so far.
Griner faces 9 years in the penal colony, according to her legal team. She was transferred last week from a detention center outside Moscow. Reuters has requested comment from Russia's Federal Prison Service on where Griner is being taken and where she is now. Russia hasn't responded yet to a prisoner swap proposal Biden had floated in late July to secure Griner's release as well as the release of jailed U.S. Marine Paul Whelan. The souring of ties between Russia and the West over the war in Ukraine has complicated the talks. In a statement, Griner's agent said the athlete's health and well-being continues to be their primary concern. Russia hasn't disclosed Griner's current location or her final destination. Griner, a two-time Olympic gold medalist, was arrested in February in Moscow for carrying vape cartridges containing cannabis oil, which is banned in Russia. She was sentenced on charges of possessing and smuggling drugs.
Ryan Chang reporting. Ukraine's electric power supply system has suffered greatly from Russia's shelling, but one school in the city of Khmelnytsky operates no matter what. Tatiana Kukurika visited the school. Anna Rice narrates her story.
This three-story building is a language school in the city of Khmelnytsky, Ukraine. Almost 1,000 children and adults come here to learn 10 foreign languages or perfect their Ukrainian. The learning continues even when Russian shelling cuts off the electricity.
The first evening, when there was no electricity, the school wasn't prepared. But the next day, we were ready. There were still problems with internet connection, but there was light.
The school's management kept the school operating by using an alternate power source, electric vehicles.
While we have power, we charge one electric vehicle, and the other one serves as a source of electricity for the school. When the first one runs out of power, we switch them.
The makeshift charging station is just outside the language school. Nichiparuk says they charge the three electric vehicles they have only when the country's power demand is low.
This car gives the school electricity for a day. That one is a little better, so it gives enough electricity for 36 hours.
Thanks to this ingenious approach, the school keeps operating.
If there is no electricity, there would be no classes. But now that we have a so-called power bank on wheels, the school management found a way to keep the school running.
Power from the electric vehicles is used for just the bare minimum: security cameras and classroom lights. All the light bulbs have been swapped for energy-saving ones.
When the country is in such a situation, electricity is scarce, and you realize every light bulb you use is a burden on the country's power grid, you know you need to switch and use energy-saving ones. If there is no electricity, the administrators know they need to flip the switch, and now they're using the backup power source. See, the lights are working, but we're not using the city's power grid.
Where there is a will for learning, these Ukrainians found a way to keep studying. For Tatiana Kukurika in Khmelnytsky, Ukraine, Anna Rice, VOA News.
That'll do it for us today. Stay up to date with continuing coverage on Ukraine and news from around the world 24 hours a day at voanews.com and on our social media platforms. Just follow VOA News. On behalf of the entire Flashpoint Ukraine team, thanks for listening. Until next time, from VOA News in Washington, I'm Steve Karish.
America, Washington, D.C.